is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. A fight between two groups who knew each other escalated to a mass shooting last night in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Three people are dead and 15 others injured.
Officers arrived on the scene and began treating people immediately while trying to deal with the chaos of that situation. Bystanders, some of them had already started administering treatment.
Las Cruces Police Chief Jeremy Story, no arrests yet. After going into a Rome hospital 5 weeks ago with pneumonia, Pope Francis will be discharged back to the Vatican tomorrow, says one of his doctors, Sergio Alfieri.
The Holy Father, at the time of his admission to Gemelli Hospital, presented an acute respiratory failure due to polymicrobial infection, viruses, bacteria, and mycetes.
Mycoses are fungus infections. The wife of former Massachusetts governor and Democratic presidential candidate Michael Dukakis, Kitty Dukakis, has died, says her son. She was 88. This is ABC News. Thousands of passengers remain stuck by delays and cancellations from yesterday's power outage at London's Heathrow Airport. The British government has ordered an investigation into what it calls the country's energy resilience after the electrical substation fire to see if any upgrades are needed for security. The U.S. Coast Guard and other agencies searching for three people, an adult and two minors, missing after their boat capsized yesterday near Goat Island on the St. Johns River in Jacksonville, Florida. City Fire and Rescue Department Captain Eric Prosswimmer.
We have recovered the boat, and it was flipped. We flipped it back over, and it was towed back to the dock, and FWC is doing their investigation on it now.
Those are fish and wildlife officials. Four people who were on top of the overturned boat were rescued by a Jacksonville Sheriff's Office Marine unit. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Judge Brad Schimmel surrounds himself with extremists. He's supported by national and state anti-abortion organizations because he opposes abortion rights. But don't take my word for it. Hear it from Schimmel himself. When asked about abortion, he said,
"We have to shut this down. We have to shut this down."
When asked about Wisconsin's abortion ban, which doesn't include exceptions for rape, incest, or help of the mother,
the 1849 ban on abortions, which, by the way, what is flawed about that law? What is flawed about that law?
Brad Schimmel takes the side of extremists and would place politicians in charge of decisions that individuals should be making. By taking the side of extremists, he's not listening to Wisconsin residents. Tell Judge Brad Schimmel, keep extremist politics out of our court decisions. Call 262-548-7548. That's 262-548-7548. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is joining forces with Elon Musk and his new government department to cut 10,000 jobs at the U.S. Postal Service. But staff are pushing back. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Diamonstein says older adults, veterans, and others depend on the service's commitment to deliver mail to everyone, regardless of where they live, noting the Postal Service delivers to every address in the country, 169 million addresses, and 318 million pieces of mail every day.
Part of the effort on Thursday is to make the postal customers around the country fully aware of this threat, to what belongs to them.
In a letter to Congress, DeJoy said the agency needs help with lease renewals on its retail centers and tackling the issue of counterfeit postage. The Trump administration has also floated the idea of privatizing the post office. Supporters argue the change would make the Postal Service run more efficiently and save money. Polling from the Pew Research Center finds 72% of Americans have a favorable view of the Postal Service. Local unions in Kentucky are participating in a National Day of Action tomorrow. Diamonstein explains that more than five decades ago, postal workers won collective bargaining rights. He says the union is prepared to fight back on any attempt to weaken union rights or target worker protections and working conditions.
It's also very important, I think, for the public to be reminded that good living wage jobs help our communities. They help make them stronger. That good jobs turn over in the community, to restaurants, to small retail stores, to housing.
According to the APWU, privatization would eliminate more than 600,000 living wage union jobs, including those of more than 70,000 military veterans.
That's Nadia Ramlagan. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson for Civic Media News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. iHeartRadio weather mostly cloudy tonight, low in the upper 30s. A shower possible. Areas of rain and maybe some snow mixed late tomorrow. Cloudy sky and a high in the mid-40s. Warmer into next week. Some 40s to start, then 50s and 60s later on in the week.
It's 39 right now.
Pat Kreitlow. On Monday, we'll talk to the Economics Department Chair at UW-Eau Claire about the hit Wisconsin's going to take in Donald Trump's trade war.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin. For all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Welcome in to Hour 2 of the Civic Media Spotlight. First up, we'll hear a segment from Mino and the Mayor out of Green Bay. Jim and John welcome on Cardi Josephson from the Walk to End Alzheimer's, who also brings along a special guest, former Wisconsin Governor Marty Schreiber. Governor Schreiber has recently penned a book called My Two Elaines about the story of caregiving for his wife, Elaine. He writes about having to watch his beloved wife gradually transform from the woman who had gracefully entertained in the executive residence to one who sometimes no longer recognizes him as her husband. Net proceeds from the sales of My Two Elaines will be used to promote Alzheimer's caregiver support programs. Here's their conversation.
Now, back to Mino and the Mayor. Here's John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
Hey, thank you very much. Welcome back, Mino and the Mayor. The Mayor, of course, still on vacation. We got Dennis Peters filling in for us, and thank you to Mark Hewson. Well, right now, we've got a couple of people that are also involved in a very, very serious thing that, again, I swear affects somebody in everybody's family. Cardi Josephson, of course, from the Alzheimer's Foundation, the Walk to End Alzheimer's coming up, and a very, very special guest. We are honored to have this gentleman, and I'm going to leave that to you, Cardi, to introduce this very distinguished gentleman.
Yes, my sidekick for, well, yesterday and today, former Wisconsin Governor, Mr. Marty Schreiber.
Yeah, good morning.
You want a drum roll, Marty?
You're the first governor we've ever had in our studio.
Is that right? Well, thank you. That's quite an honor then for me to do that.
I didn't want to say this should be one of your top honors in your career, but
yeah. And by the way, I see a happy birthday. Is the day your birthday?
It was St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, St. Patrick's Day. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
If I would have known it, I would have signed an executive order for being so intelligent and wise.
I work with a former mayor of Green Bay here every single day, and he's never given me an executive order.
Yeah, well, that's.
I think he tried setting one to get me out of town one day. But
was
anyway.
That a restraining order?
Well, maybe that's what it
was.
Is
that what it was?
One of the two. But, Cardi, thank you for this beautiful food from Uncle Mike's.
You are welcome, John.
It will not
happy
go to
belated.
Waste. Thank you so very much.
You bet.
First of all, I want to talk to you, sir, I'd like to talk to you about this book that you wrote. I'm a local author, and I like to write books. But this one, I think, is a very poignant personal story of how you got involved with the Alzheimer's Foundation in a way, because it was personal with your wife, correct, sir?
That's correct. And I'll tell you, had it not been for the Alzheimer's Association, quite frankly, I don't know how I would have made it. My wife experienced and died from Alzheimer's over a period of almost 20 years. And in that period of time, I went through what every caregiver goes through, and that's just the grieving, the anxiety, the worry, the depression, the sadness, the feeling of abandonment, the lonely, all of those things come into play. And if it wouldn't have been for the Alzheimer's, I wouldn't have made it. But the title of my book is My Two Elaines. And the first Elaine is a wonderful woman that I married and had, you know, 4 children, 13 grandchildren, now 11 great-grandchildren.
What a beautiful woman.
But the second Elaine same person began to appear when she was approximately 63, 64 years of age. And she would get lost driving to and from places she had been going to and from for 10 years. A great cook messed up recipes so badly she would cry, coming up with stories that I couldn't believe she would even imagine. That was the beginning of the second Elaine. And there were some things that I learned too late. We missed out on moments of joy. We could have had greater opportunities to experience helping each other live our best life possible. But I was arrogant. I was self-centered. I said I could do it alone. And I tell you, I got involved with the caregiver's poison, a little bit of alcohol. And all of a sudden, it began to dawn on me that I was not really serving the one I love by being so self-centered. I was not serving her by refusing to ask for help. I was not serving her by not taking care of myself. So that's why I wrote the book. I want to help caregivers learn, cope, and survive.
But that comes from a place of love, though. You know, you want to be the one that takes care of things. You want to be the one, because that's the role that you do when you say, I do. You know, and to do those things, I think that's very commendable. But, yeah, you're right, though. I think it does add up after a while, and it can become, you know, out of your wheelhouse of what you can do. And it's only natural, and I'm just glad that you, like you say, you found the association to help you with
that. But I think on the other hand, too, I think it also opened your eyes just how tough of a foe this is.
Yes.
Because everybody thinks, well, I'm the strong guy. I was governor. I can handle this. But Alzheimer's is such a tough enemy, isn't it, Carrie?
Oh, absolutely. And just caregiving in general, whether you're caring for somebody with Alzheimer's or dementia or any other situation, it takes its toll, and you really can't do it yourself. It's about really having a good support team around you.
I think everybody knows somebody who has been affected by
everybody.
It. And that's it. It didn't used to be like that. I think it's something that's kind of growing. There's more and more diagnoses.
Yes, exactly.
And it's horrible.
Yes. We're living longer, but also we're getting better about diagnosing it.
One thing I want to make everyone aware of. 40% of caregivers die before their loved one due to stress-related illness.
Really?
A person who is a caregiver has a 60% higher death rate than non-caregivers.
What?
So what the point is that when there is a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, there are two patients, the person who is ill and then also the caregiver. And unless we realize that, we're going to just see caregiving among all of the things in the world is probably one of the most challenging. Because of all of the emotions and experiences you go through as you see your loved one disappear almost daily. And my heart goes out to every caregiver, to every family who is dealing with this Alzheimer's disease. And that comes us right down to what Carrie is about. And that is to help people better learn, cope, and survive, making sure we get the research involved. And if I could encourage anything, it's to get involved with Carrie, the Alzheimer's Association, and their walk.
You know what? I've just in the ones in, from my family members where I've dealt with this, okay? The one thing that, again, why this is such a vicious thing is because there will be moments of total clarity of you're talking to that exact same person you've known your whole life, and then 10 minutes later, you don't recognize the person. They don't recognize you. That's got to be an extremely frustrating feeling, right?
Well, so Elaine was in assisted living for roughly 8.5 years, so we're having lunch. And she's beginning to cry. And she looks at me, and I said, why are you crying? Well, she says, I'm beginning to love you more than my husband. Well, I didn't ask her what's wrong with her turkey husband. I didn't do that at all. But the point is, and what is so important, it was not necessary for her to know my name in order for our hearts to touch.
Sure.
And many times people say, well, that person doesn't recognize me. Well, I don't want any. No, hearts can touch by holding a hand, by giving a hug, by singing a song, by giving a smile. And so people could please understand that.
I've learned that, too.
I just want to reintroduce you. We're with Carrie Josephson, Alzheimer's Foundation, Marty Schreiber, former governor for the state of Wisconsin, who wrote a phenomenal book, it looks like, My Two Elaines, talking about learning, coping, and surviving as an Alzheimer's caregiver.
That's a beautiful picture of the two of you, by the way. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you. That goes back, maybe when we were 22 or 23 years old, and I know I look only 39, but I'm 85, but you can get sort of a pushback.
I think it's a beautiful thing that you said regarding the conversation with your wife that I've learned something, too, of what you meet them where they're at. Mm-hmm. And from that point, that's where you can get the traction on the communication and whatnot. And I think it's a beautiful thing that you shared that.
Okay, what you just said is brilliant. It's the key to it, joining their world. As long as we try and keep them in our world, it's impossible.
Right.
And so, but to join them where they are at is one of the most important, best things you can do, both for the person ill as well as the caregiver and the entire family.
Carrie, could you put that into words, what you've seen in people doing that?
I think what Marty's talking about is, you know, sometimes people, you know, they get a diagnosis and the caregiver maybe don't understand exactly, you know, what they're dealing with. And, you know, it can get tiring when, you know, the person is repeating themselves or asking the same question over and over or saying something that's not at all correct. But it's really about not battling with them. You know, does it matter if they think that it's 3 p.m. instead of 9 a.m? I know Marty talks oftentimes about his wife wanting to have a glass of wine in the morning. Who cares? Just roll with it.
Before I went to print with the book, I find a series of notes and journals that Elaine had been keeping. Each chapter begins with some of Elaine's notes or journals. That gives us a thorough understanding of what it's like to be diagnosed with this disease, to have all of those questions come into mind, to think you're normal, to not think you're normal, to worry about whether or not things are going along, what's going to happen in the future, and then to get angry with. People have told me that that book has really made a difference in their life, helping them learn, cope, and survive. And the notes that Elaine wrote that are in the book gives us that kind of insight.
What is the process like of going from, I think maybe I'm not quite, not like I used to be, for example, how does that process start to getting diagnosis aspect of it? I mean, what kind of time span are we talking about? And, you know, from that aspect, what was your experience like?
Well, she was getting lost, as I said, going to and from places. And I was in refusal. You know, I didn't want to accept that. I didn't want to accept
denial,
that at all.
Kind of?
I was denial.
Yeah.
And so we finally went to a family doctor who said, you better check this out. And so we went to a psychiatrist. They have what they call the mini test. What day is it? Who's president of the United States? Do you use real cream for your hair? All those kinds of things.
I'm just throwing it out there.
Vitalis.
You know, I got these. Okay, I'm reading these things from her notes.
Yes.
Wow, you're not hiding anything with what she said here.
I didn't want to.
I got this one. Date unknown, but this is from your wife, Elaine. I wish my Alzheimer's would dissipate. I'd like to be the smart wife and mother I used to be. Now I have to waste so much time just trying to figure out what I should be doing without seeming as smart as I used to be. I need to rely on Marty for everything, and I'm very lucky he continues to keep me. Life gets more difficult every day.
And so if you read further, she gets to the point where she gets very angry with me because she felt I was controlling her. I want you to know that when we had prayed together and we had cried together, but until I read her notes did I ever understand the courage that it takes to be diagnosed with this illness and go forward. And never did I realize that. Elaine, it didn't happen on a Thursday. It happened on a Friday. Elaine, it wasn't the Smiths of John. What is going on is, why is she being criticized for thinking things? She didn't know what she said when she said it. And so I wrote the book. I want to help caregivers learn, cope, and survive. I want to have that journey, as challenging as it is, to be as fruitful and as productive of happy moments as possible.
I just want to read one thing. I believe this is from you, a little excerpt you have in there. What I wish I had known, asking others to help does not mean you're not strong enough or not trying hard enough.
I try and drive home the point that to ask for help means you're not giving up. And also to not ask for help is a sign of arrogance.
Okay, one more I want to read. I should have enlisted a couple of friends to be my team captains who could do the asking and scheduling for me. That's a very practical thing in that aspect.
Well, there again, it's a selfishness. I can do it myself.
Right.
And in the meantime, I'm sort of digging my own grave because I'm not taking care of myself.
Wow, this is fascinating. We're going to send her a quick break. We'll be back with more. Carrie Josephson and Marty Schreiber, former Wisconsin governor, walk to end Alzheimer's. We'll talk about that when we come back. Okay, Carrie?
All right.
Great, thanks.
Got my chips cashed in, keep trucking. Mino and the Mayor is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WISS and WGBW weekday mornings from 6 until 9. To learn more about this show and all of Civic Media's programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Folks, we've got to talk about Derek Van Orden. The second-term congressman representing Wisconsin's 3rd District is at it again, dodging public meetings and making all kinds of unhinged comments. As many scramble and struggle to understand the chaos of what's happening in Washington, D.C. and how it's impacting people here in Wisconsin, Van Orden has been as frustrating and disrespectful as ever. In one instance, Van Orden took to social media to berate a veteran who had been fired from his job at the VA by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. And the veteran in question is simply someone who was just reaching out to his congressman, looking for answers. Van Orden's office has also hastily canceled public meetings, and he has made some especially wild accusations about people who have been attending these public events. Congressman Van Orden needs to stop this unhinged madness and, more importantly, be more available and accountable to his constituents.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. This is the Talk of La Crosse. Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Next up on the Civic Media Spotlight, we go to the John and Gordy Show down in Madison. Every week, John and Gordy talk with Pam Yonke, the fabulous farm babe and host of the Midwest Farm Report. This time around, they talk chocolate milk and also a new study out showing just how rural Wisconsin is these days.
WMDX 92.7, John and Gordy in the morning, broadcasting from the capital city, Madison, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Chilly start this morning, about 33 degrees. Highs today in mid-50s, a mix of clouds and some sunshine. We'll check in with Brittany Merlot in about an hour and get the latest on the weekend weather. Right now, Pam Yonke is with us. Good morning, Pam, from Midwest Farm Report.
Morning,
girl. How you doing?
Yep.
Good.
I was good. I was talking to somebody yesterday that came through the building, and they were a little bit shocked at our weather. I'm like, wait a minute. Yesterday was the first day of spring. I said, right. It's Wisconsin boys basketball. I said, if you're a homer like me and grew up in this state, you could just about predict what we were going to have with the weather this week. So safe travels to everybody that's coming back to Madison for the rest of the playoff weekend.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, yes.
Let's hope they're drinking a lot of milk while they're here.
Well, I was telling you guys that's one thing that we've been kind of bringing up in conversations from time to time, how the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin is one of the strong messages you'll see in a lot of the sport venues for high school athletes is reminding them that chocolate milk has been scientifically proven to be one of the best ways to recharge after a workout. And a lot of school systems, through the help of their dairy farmers, have actually put coolers in their locker rooms so that when the athletes come off the field or off the floor and are kind of looking to rebuild after a game, they have nice ice cold chocolate milk to help their bodies do it.
Boy, I love chocolate milk.
Yeah, me too.
It's the best. Too. It really is. Didn't they take it out of the menu for a while, school lunch menu?
Oh, yeah. You very rarely will you see chocolate milk on even the low-fat chocolate milk. It has a dilly of a time trying to get onto school lunch menus. That's kind of a never-ending anthem out in Washington, D.C. by a lot of dairy farm advocates is trying to just get the right milk into schools at the right temperature in the right containers to keep it attractive to kids. It's semantics.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. Well, now there's a new research facility that you mentioned to us off the air, and they're taking a look at the real makeup of Wisconsin's rural community. And this sounds pretty interesting, actually. What did they come up with?
I did a poll this morning on my early show and just asked people, do you think Wisconsin is still rural? I mean, if you think about it, a lot of us are of the age where we might have grown up rural, but obviously Wisconsin's dynamics have changed quite a little bit. So there's a group called the Rural Policy Institute. It started last July. It is not an advocacy group. It's not a lobbying group. It's basically a group that's trying to answer these kinds of questions for policy development in the future. They're not going to introduce policy or anything like that. They just want to be a think tank of sorts to try to provide information in areas where there hasn't been any. This is one of the first things that they tackled. And basically what they found is you really got to define what is rural. I'll give you an example. So you guys know where Waupaca is, right? Up in the central Sands area. Okay, now that's a perfect example of rural adjacent, they call it. So Waupaca's probably, I don't know, I haven't looked lately, but it's probably got a population about, what, five to 10,000 people,
yeah,
right?
That sounds right, yeah.
It's in kind of the middle of nowhere, no disrespect to the central Sands, but Waupaca is surrounded by rural. So those are the kinds of things they're pointing out. Same thing for some of you that go up to Rhinelander. Rhinelander's probably got a population maybe 10, 12,000, but it's surrounded by rural. So what they've done in this scientific breakout is take a look at population densities and where they're at in Wisconsin. And it looks like it's about 40% very rural, probably about another 20% we could call rural adjacent. You've got about 40%, your Green Bay's, La Crosse's, Eau Claire's, Madison's, Milwaukee's, that would be urban. And then you've got the remaining percentage that are in kind of the suburbs, shall we say. But it's really all designed to try to make sure that people that are elected from areas like Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, pay attention to the fact that the policy that they're putting in play has a major impact on rural and rural adjacent citizens.
Well, that's interesting.
Interesting study. Yeah. Pam, we got a question from a listener. Throw this question in the mix here from a listener. John and Gordy asked Pam what we can do to protect family farms from huge corporate farm takeovers. That's kind of a big question, but what's your take on that?
Maybe we tackle that at another time. I think it's a question that's worth discussing, but it's a big one, and it all goes back to a lot of it is family dynamics. What are you going to do if the kids don't want to farm? Mom and dad can only do it for so long. You have to try to come up with a succession transition plan. Maybe you reach out to the kids' neighbor friends that's still farming. That's what I've mentioned to you guys before. I get riled up a little bit when people say, we're losing farms. We're not losing farms. They're just looking different. The cows go to the neighbors. The land is rented by the neighbors, but that farm is still there. So I appreciate the question. I really do. And we talk about it a lot, but it might be a little big for us to tear into in a couple minutes on the Gordy and John show.
Gotcha. Oh, thank you for getting the billing right on the name of the show. Appreciate that.
What's that?
Never mind, John. All right. You missed it.
I was actually just contemplating the other topic we were going to talk about, and that is the milk movement. What is that all about?
Well, really, it's kind of helping consumers better understand how dairying is changing. Now, Wisconsin is still obviously very robust. We're number two in the nation as far as milk production, but things are changing. We're starting to see big, major cheese plants going in places like South Dakota? Kansas.
Wow, Dakota.
Things like that. And I'm not just talking little ones. These are whoppers, fellas. And it's something that we've got to kind of keep in mind when it comes to Wisconsin's dairy competitive edge and making sure that we're recognizing, just like our lives on a daily basis, the dairy industry and its look and its flow of milk changing too. We might be sending some Wisconsin milk to Kansas to help them power that cheese plant that they're bringing online. But like I said, I thought it was worth reminding people that, holy Moses, milk moves a long distance in the United States, and we're lucky we've got as many cheesemakers in Wisconsin to use local use of it.
Well, that champion cheesemaker was from Wisconsin. He's now in another state, so we're importing the cheesemakers and now the milk, so what the heck?
There you go.
All good. All right, Pam. Well, thank you very much. We hope you have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again Monday morning. Thank you.
All right, buddy. It's always a pleasure. Have a good one.
You too. Pam Yonke from the Midwest Farm Report. That's actually coming up right around the corner right here. And then it's Idiocracy time on John and Gordy in the Morning, WMDX for a Friday. Good morning.
The John and Gordy Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WMDX weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. A fight between two groups who knew each other escalated to a mass shooting last night in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Three people are dead and 15 others injured.
Officers arrived on the scene and began treating people immediately while trying to deal with the chaos of that situation. Bystanders, some of them had already started administering treatment.
Las Cruces Police Chief Jeremy Story, no arrests yet. After going into a Rome hospital 5 weeks ago with pneumonia, Pope Francis will be discharged back to the Vatican tomorrow, says one of his doctors, Sergio Alfieri.
The Holy Father, at the time of his admission to Gemelli Hospital, presented an acute respiratory failure due to polymicrobial infection, viruses, bacteria, and mycetes.
Mycoses are fungus infections. The wife of former Massachusetts governor and Democratic presidential candidate Michael Dukakis, Kitty Dukakis, has died, says her son. She was 88. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Badgers basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's Wisconsin against the Brigham Young Cougars. Tonight in the NCAA basketball tournament, Badgers head coach Greg Gard asked what team in the Big Ten reminds him of BYU.
Ourselves, for one. Illinois, a little bit. Illinois shoots a lot of threes. I think BYU may have even more shooters than Illinois. Obviously, for any team that's playing right now is really good.
Marquette's season is over. The Golden Eagles lost to New Mexico by 9. 75-66. Head coach Shaka Smart on letting the game slip away.
When we took the lead in the second half, we could really feel a level of momentum. We weren't able to win that next swing minute and just some mistakes that cost us on both ends of the floor.
In hockey, the Wisconsin Badgers women's hockey team skated to a 6-2 win over Minnesota last night. They'll face Ohio State tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for the national championship in Minneapolis. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. iHeartRadio weather mostly cloudy tonight, low in the upper 30s. A shower possible. Areas of rain and maybe some snow mixed late tomorrow. Cloudy sky and a high in the mid-40s. Warmer into next week. Some 40s to start, then 50s and 60s later on in the week. It's 42 right now.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A Washington state audit of rejected 2020 mail-in ballots offers insight on whose ballots are more likely to be rejected and recommends actions to reduce that number, over 37,000 in 2024. Primary reasons for rejection include ballots received or postmarked after Election Day, a missing signature on a ballot envelope, or the voter's signature couldn't be confirmed. Auditors found 2020 rates varied from a high of 1.5% in Franklin County to 0.02% in Columbia County, but they also found higher rejections of younger voters, 18 to 21, where 2.6% of ballots were rejected, and black voters at 2.5%. They also found that non-native English speakers were 47% more likely to have ballots rejected. Signature issues can often be cured, but many voters don't or can't correct it. The auditors recommended outreach programs on college campuses, sending letters and calling voters with curable signature issues, more training on signature verification, opening early voting centers 18 days before the election, an advisory committee for disabled voters, and ballot drop boxes for every 15,000 voters. In the 2024 general election, Washington's statewide rejection rate had dropped to 0.94%, but of those, over 24,000 were rejected for a mismatched signature. Find a link to the audit at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
Matt and Air on Air.
You may say to yourself, self, what if I want to contact Doge and let him know that I'm unhappy with these cuts?
Do you know who had the same idea? Congressman Mark Pocan.
We couldn't get that number off the Doge website, and they literally just said,
said that there is no one that you can speak to, and they didn't provide anything.
The administration of transparency. But you can't talk to anybody. That's okay.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Dom Selvia.
Next time, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kaye, will discuss the threats posed to Social Security by the Trump administration. Does calling about missing Social Security payments make you a fraudster? Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We return you now to the Civic Media Spotlight. Up next, we'll hear a segment from the Dom Selvia Show, along with co-host for the day, Matt Rothschild. They talk with Julie Bomar, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, about the devastating impact of President Trump's service cuts on Wisconsin farmers and food insecure populations. The program's cut in Wisconsin also linked farmers directly to schools, providing high-quality, nutritious food for students.
And welcome back to the Dom Selvia Show, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. It's a talk line. It's a text line. Usually it works. We're working on it right now, but be patient. We appreciate everyone. Matt Rothschild joining me today. Jess P.S. is on the board, and I'm jazzed as hell to introduce to you our next guest. Her name, Julie Bomar. She's the executive director from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Julie, welcome to the Dom Selvia Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is our pleasure. The administration, the federal administration, the Trump administration, making all sorts of changes. And we reported on this quite a bit yesterday. So this is a timely interview. We appreciate you joining us. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is saying that the Trump administration canceled a program that paid Wisconsin farmers to grow food for food pantries. And one of the statistics that stood out to me that I was unaware of and still kind of shocking to me is that more than 617,000 Wisconsin residents are food insecure. 617,000 Wisconsin residents are food insecure. Julie, what's your impression on how this is going to impact not only those 617,000 Wisconsin residents, but the farmers that provide that food to those pantries?
It's going to have devastating effects. The local food purchase assistance program has been in effect for several years now. And, you know, COVID really woke us all up, right, to the problems in the supply chain and how we don't really have access to fresh food. If anything happens, it's a fragile food system. And so there were some monies that were made available at that time. And really what happened is it just helped develop a structure that could provide food insecure people with fresh, nutritious, protein-ridden food that was locally grown by farmers, by their neighbors, and it benefited groups of farmers that don't often benefit from the Farm Bill. And it developed a great infrastructure across the entire state so that smaller farmers could actually participate in the food system in a way that they hadn't before. It's had a hell of an impact. And we're really, really upset that contracts and promises are broken.
Apparently, the USDA Deputy Administrator, Jack Tuckwiller, wrote when they sent a letter canceling this program, that this program, quote, no longer effectuates agency priorities. Then I'm wondering.
That's bureaucratic talk for you.
What is the USDA priority then, Julie, if not to assist farmers in at least this kind of way? Because the farmers get all sorts of other assistance, right? This isn't the only assistance that we as taxpayers provide to our farmers for our agriculture and our food supply chain and all that. Why is it that this one is being targeted, in your opinion?
Well, I think that it was focused on farmers that don't often maybe meet the stereotypical definition of farmer in the United States. And so commodity growers, big commodity growers, may often benefit from subsidy programs, from insurance and benefits like that by way of growing commodities. A lot of the smaller growers, which actually are all across Wisconsin, we have a very diversified agricultural landscape. Many of those farmers do not get to benefit in the same ways. They may be a specialty crop grower, and then you don't get subsidies, from the United States government. You may be growing hay, and you don't get subsidies from the United States government, whereas the big big guys, the big boys of it all do. They at least more eligible for it. So this one really targeted those folks that are often left out in the Farm Bill by helping them get into these food systems, these highways, if you will, that literally can distribute food in smaller, more local quantities and qualities.
Folks, you're listening to the Dom Salvia Show. That is Julie Bomar, the executive director from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. According to the reporting, Julie, the program, 289 Wisconsin farms participated in the program, providing $4.2 million worth of food to more than 250 pantries and schools. I mean, so this impacts everybody, regardless of ideological or political leaning. Julie, I'm assuming you have all sorts of political stripes in your organization. How are folks reacting to this?
Well, it's really been interesting to watch all of the federal actions and how they're impacting folks. We have a big tent organization, lots of different kinds of growers, and we did a survey just a few weeks ago to see how the federal decisions were affecting people, and all different kinds of stories came out. And so it kind of depends on what sector you're in and you know, how you've been directly impacted, but the stories are varied, and almost universally there's been negative impact on our members. There are a few who wrote in that they're hopeful that maybe tariffs and things like that will help them in some way, because there may be a smaller producer and they're hoping that the local folks will have to buy more food from them because the costs are going to go up on imported foods. So, you know, there has been some differences in opinion, but the vast majority of folks that have written in and have showed up at our town halls are saying this negatively impacts them.
Julie, do you know, you have folks, farmers with different political leanings. Do you know any that have expressed little buyer's remorse to you? They voted for Trump and now, holy smokes, he's taking our programs away. He's taking our subsidies away.
You know, I haven't had anybody just come up and say they had buyer's remorse. I mean, certainly farmers are not a monolith. We all know that, right? There are differences of opinion. They may say, I kind of am waiting to see what happens in this area. I don't like what's happening over here. I think it's an overreach. So I think it's not necessarily an easy yes or no or buyer's remorse or not. But a lot of folks, of course, didn't vote for Trump either. So they didn't go into this with those kinds of expectations.
You know, I drive down 94 between Madison and Milwaukee, and I'm always surprised at these huge Trump signs in the farmers' fields. And I'm just scratching my head, you know, what is it that Trump has given these folks that make them so zealous in favor of him? Do you have any clue on that?
Well, I think we've had four decades, multiple administrations to demonstrate that the Farm Bill doesn't work for all farmers. And so whether you're Democrat or Republican, you probably have a beef with the way that the federal government is managing helping shape the food system. And so, you know, there's a lot of folks that really believe that big ag and big pharma need to go, and they maybe saw a disruptor that could change and help shake those things loose. I think that certainly is an opinion by some. Others may have a lot of trouble with the regulatory control that we see at the state and the federal level as well. So there's a large factor of reasons that people may choose this. I think one thing that I can say that working in the farm community for a long time, that farmers believe contracts should be honored. And so that one's really, they're not being honored.
And one of those contracts is to schools. I mean, fresh food for school lunches, those are being cut. And, you know, I thought this was a great program so the kids can have something, you know, fresher than tater tots that are deep fried, you know, when the local farmers bring food to the school. And how many schools are going to be impacted by this cut on this program?
Oh, there's 30 just up in my region and the small few county area. It's going to be massive if you look across the state. And we have close to 300 food pantries that are going to be impacted by the termination of the local food purchase assistance program, close to 300 farmers. It is going to have a big impact. I also happen to sit on a board of directors for a local food bank, and they're very concerned about how they're going to be procuring fresh meat, fresh eggs and, you know, all those high quality things that they were getting from the program. And especially because they were counting on it. Remember, a lot of the farmers are already planting right now in their greenhouses. They agreed to uphold their end of the bargain, and they're put out the work, they put out the money, and now that's going to be cut. That's what's so irritating, I think, to many, is that it's just a matter of integrity.
So that violation of that contract, of that word that the government gave them, is so galling to them right now, on top of the fact that they're going to have an economic negative impact, too.
Absolutely.
Folks, you're listening to the Dom Salvia Show. That is Julie Bomar, executive director from the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Matt Rothschild joining us today as well. Some of the reporting continuing on this, this Stepping Stones of Dunn County, they use this program to provide 50,000 pounds of food to its clients. And apparently, this pantry feeds more than 11% of Dunn County. Now, I know some of these counties don't have a lot of people, but 11% is a lot of people. That's a big percentage of the population. I don't care how many people are in that county, Julie. And this is all to save, if I'm understanding the math here, is this like a $4-some million program? Is that's what's being cut here?
Yeah, exactly. And it was really run efficiently. How much more efficient can you get than shipping locally, right? And the money stays in the economy. It's not going out to Walmart and then to Arkansas. I mean, this is like literally an economic booster for rural economies as well. So it was run effectively. And I lived in Dunn County for 30 some years. I remember talking to physicians. I did a lot of research on rural poverty in a previous career. There are people who are malnourished, not just like they cannot leave their community to go in to these food pantries. So these pop-up pantries and things that they have in rural Wisconsin are critical for people who cannot afford to even drive into town. And so it is incredibly serious. And I think, you know, most people, regardless of their political affiliation, agree that we should try to keep things efficient and local and do the best that we can for those folks that are literally, you know, malnourished.
Well, and I think it was just brought up, and I want to reiterate it again. This is fresh farm food. You know, these aren't bags of chips. These aren't, you know, processed by big food manufacturing. This is money that's being circulated through the local economy more than once, right? We hear people about that are hiring some part-time help to help, you know, to help them in these endeavors. Well, that also, you know, it creates employment. It creates food security. It creates a secure food supply lines, as you mentioned before. COVID really exposed a lot of these concerns. So as a literally a, as an investment on the dollar, it's hard to think of another program that would have the impact that this program, and it's I hate to say $4 million is not a big program, but it's really not, especially when you consider some of the monies that, I don't know, the President of the United States spends when he goes in Air Force One to go golfing, I believe, at about $3.5 million per when he's got to pull out the plane. You know, these efforts are being done, Julie, to effectuate a justification for trillions of dollars in tax cuts. And people can have an opinion whether or not they think that's righteous or just. Are your members and the people in your communities, do they recognize that this is the impetus for all of this? That's why we're doing this, is to justify and pay for tax cuts.
I think that there more work needs to be done on connecting the dots there, for sure, Dom. I think that a lot of folks were excited, you know, maybe about more efficient government or wasteful programs being targeted, and they maybe didn't sign up for the kinds of cuts that we're seeing, and they weren't sure where they were going to be targeted. But rural America is going to be hit particularly lopsidedly in all of this. And, you know, people, I think, are starting to put it together.
Do you have a moment to come around on the next segment as well? I want to ask about tariffs and what you saw as the impact currently and perhaps what was done in the past. But while we have just this one segment, appreciate your time. The local politicians in these areas, is there any discussions? Have they shown up at any of the meetings? Have they, you know, provided any insight, right, left, regardless of their political leanings? Are they involved in the community, and what are their thoughts? Have you heard anything?
We've heard a lot from local elected officials. We did have a town hall that we sponsored a few weeks ago. We offered it open to representatives. We're a nonpartisan organization. We invite everybody. And the only folks to show up were on the Democratic side of the aisle. Although I have seen, signs that GOP representatives are visiting food pantries and food banks. So that's good to see. We were disappointed that they didn't show up.
Folks are listening to the Dom Salvia Show. Come back with us. Julie Bomar, Executive Director from Wisconsin Farmers Union. Matt Rothschild as well. Jess P.S. working on the board. I want to get into some of the tariff conversations and what you're hearing on the current situation. Plus, I want to get your feedback on how it went the last time Donald Trump started a trade
war. The Dom Salvia Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from 4 till 6. To learn more about this show and all the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
Do you know or work with kids who have special healthcare needs? Help them live their best lives. Contact Wisconsin Wayfinder Children's Resource Network. Our specialists will connect you with services in your area. Wisconsin Wayfinder is free and confidential. Call 877-947-2929 or visit dhs.wi.gov/wiscway. Connect today. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
More farm-related programs being canceled. Those affect more than $1 billion in purchasing local food from farmers for food banks.
These types of programs, it gets high-quality food to people who need it at an affordable price. It's a win-win-win, and it's just a really good investment in these rural economies.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, weekday morning 6 until 8, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to the Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Closing out this week's Civic Media Spotlight, we go to Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. The Schwabinator welcomes on Up North News' Christina Laurie to talk about the best frozen pizzas in Wisconsin and some inventions you might not know were from this great state.
Twice as much frozen pizza as the rest of the country. Wisconsin is the frozen pizza capital of the world. These are just some of the fun things you learn when you read Up North News, which is edited by our current guest, Christina Laurie, who joins us over the stream. Christina, here are some other fun facts that I thought were very funny. Pizza facts. 30% of Americans eat pizza at least once a week. 22% say they can finish an entire pie by themselves. That sounds like bragging. I'm not sure it should be. And then 19% enjoy a beer with their pizza. Seems like it should be higher.
All of those stats, I don't know, to me, don't they seem a little low? I feel like we might have a few liars because yes. I do think that more people than are admitting could finish an entire pizza.
I agree. I get like this spinach mushroom pizza, very thin crust. I can polish that up. It's only like the whole pizza is like 900 calories. You know, it's not like I'm bragging, but some of them are smaller.
No, it cracks me up. Like to look at the serving sizes sometimes on those frozen pizzas in grocery stores. It says like serve six. And I'm like, no, this looks like a personal pizza. There is a funny quote that said any pizza is a personal pizza with enough hard work and determination.
That was probably created in Wisconsin. It said, this is interesting too. Favorite topping was cheese. That shouldn't even be, I feel like that's not even a topping really. It just kind of comes with the pizza. But then it says, followed by pepperoni, 66%, sausage, 58%, and mushrooms, 53%. That surprised me. I know Conrad's shaking his head. He loves mushrooms on pizza, but were you surprised by that?
Oh, absolutely. I don't believe in vegetables on pizza. I believe in vegetables separately, but I don't want them touching
right.
the pizza.
Have a salad. Keep them off the pizza. And then one more piece of pizza tidbit I thought was interesting in what you wrote. Favorite chain, Pizza Hut, 31%, followed by Papa John's, 22%, and Domino's at 17%. I see Domino's vehicles all over the place. That surprised me. Like Pizza Hut almost doubling Domino's.
I completely agree with you. And out of those three, I do personally prefer Domino's.
Yeah, I do too. They make a pretty good thin crust pizza, I will say, for what it is, you know.
Yeah, again, I will never say no to a pizza.
All right. So now that we've gotten everybody hungry, let's talk. You did another article about three inventions or three things that were created more or less in Wisconsin. Another great thing that you learn at Up North News, just informative. Stem cells, Social Security. Can you elaborate on these things that you wrote about?
Absolutely. So I'm glad that I'm not the only one that's surprised by these findings. I mean, I've lived in Wisconsin now for 8 years. I know many of your listeners have probably been, you know, lifelong Wisconsinites. But still, I mean, working in news for 8 years, I feel like I should know most things about the state. And every day I'm just like learning new things that were started here, a person who was from here, someone who has family living here. And these inventions just kind of like caught me off guard. So weather satellites, incredibly important for actually forecasting the weather, especially now that there are so many, you know, layoffs of local meteorologists. Those are so important. That started here in the late 1950s. A lot of these inventions started at the UW-Madison. It was just like a hotbed of innovation. Social Security also started there. It's just incredible. So if there are any Badger alum, you probably know Whitty Hall. That's named after the father of Social Security, Edwin Whitty.
I love when I find stuff like that out. Like my son went to Madison. He lived on Doty Street. And then I was in the Edgewater Hotel once and I saw a picture of a guy named Doty. I'm like, oh, there you go. Same thing with Whitty Hall. I was going to ask you about that. So he's got a dorm named after him and he created Social Security. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I mean, FDR, one of just kind of the most...
Certainly the longest serving.
You say nowadays. Yeah. I was going to say most admired, but nowadays I don't know if that's accurate. I hope it would. He's definitely one of the most impactful presidents. Sure. He handpicked Whitty to serve on committee on economic security, which helped create the Social Security Act of 1935, which 66 million people benefit from today. So that's a huge impact from just one Badger. And then last thing that was created here was just the entire process of space-based astronomy. It's pretty crazy just considering geographically how far away Wisconsin is from any of the places you typically associate with NASA. You know, you'd see rockets taking off from mainly Florida or sometimes Texas. But we are really just like pushing the forward space innovation. We have a great astronomical observatory here and the first iteration of the famous Hubble telescope.
And you, this might have been a separate article, but you talked about how the beginning of the stem cell research process started at UW. I mean, that's a pretty big deal too. You read this stuff, it just makes you kind of proud, right?
Oh, very proud. Actually, so the fluid that they use when they perform transplants, like a kidney transplant or a liver transplant, it's actually called UW solution universally because that solution was created at the University of Wisconsin.
That's so great.
I mean, that's just such a life-saving innovation.
And one more thing along these lines I thought was interesting is, like, you know, you grow up and when you move here, and even before I moved here, from Chicago, I'd heard about Vince Lombardi my whole life and how beloved he was, even by people in Chicago. Like, he's this iconic, famous coach. How much of a supporter he was of civil rights. That was a great article. Let's pick up here. Can you stick around for a few more minutes? Can we keep you just for a few more minutes? I know you have practice pretty soon behind you at the football field there, but we'll get you over there on time.
Christina, get ready for coach.
Christina Lori is here. We're talking Vince Lombardi, and then we're going to talk pancakes before we let her go. We're having fun here at Nightlight with the editor of Up North News. It's Pete Schwabe and Nightlight on the Civic Media Radio Network. Great to have you.
Yeah.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from 6 until 8 p.m. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, Eagle 1490 AM. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we've got Angela Lang from Block here as our co-host for the day. Also, Representative Darren B. Madison, and This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. Winter is out and winning is in. It's our Break in the Spring statewide text to win contest on your local Civic Media radio station. Your daily shot at a Chula Vista getaway, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, or $100 cash. And every entry gets you closer to the grand prize, a brand new Verlo Queen mattress set complete with a mattress, sheets, protector, and pillows. Download the Civic Media app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Choose your station that gets set to win starting Monday, March 24th. It's time to break into spring with WLCX. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Macker. A mass shooting overnight in New Mexico. Three people are dead, 15 injured after gunfire broke out between two groups late Friday night. Happened at a park in the city of La Cruces, which is about 55 miles from the Mexican border. La Cruces Police Chief Jeremy Story.
Our next focus is the apprehension of those involved and those responsible for this atrocity. We will find each and every one of them, and we will hold them accountable to the criminal justice system.
So far, no arrests have been made. A tense legal battle between a federal judge and the Trump administration escalating over deportation flights that carried more than 200 Venezuelans that the White House claims are gang members. Now, a White House official saying that the Trump administration sent another group of migrants to Guantanamo Bay on Thursday this week, claiming many are members of the Venezuelan gang trend.